I'm Ken L. Nashtiger, Vice President for Student Life, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this special Monday chapel service where we are having the opportunity to host the third of our three candidates for undergraduate campus pastor. We're pleased to welcome Lana Miller, and Lana is an EMS graduate who served as interim campus pastor at EMU in 2007-08, before most of you students were actually here. Lana and her husband Andy recently served with MCC in Cambodia with oversight of programs in Vietnam, Myanmar, and Laos. Prior to seminary, Lana was the associate director of convention planning for Mennonite Church USA, so many of you who are here as students were likely at one of the conventions that she had oversight of. She had primary responsibility for the youth convention and denominational youth ministry. She has also taught youth ministry and spiritual formation at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, in addition to teaching high school chemistry before beginning youth and young adult ministry at Clinton Frame Mennonite Church in Indiana. She and her husband Andy have continued their passion for service to internationals after they returned by hosting Chinese scholars in their home. Lana holds a Master's of Divinity with a concentration in spiritual formation and a certificate in youth ministry from EMS and a Bachelor of Arts in Biology and Chemistry from Goshen College in Goshen, Indiana. For this morning's service, Lana has prepared a chapel entitled Just One, One, One. As we get started this morning, she has invited Julia Schmidt to do an opening reading from Mother Teresa, and afterwards, Lana will follow with this presentation. Julia and Lana.
I never look at the masses as my responsibility. I look only at the individual. I can love only one person at a time. I can feed only one person at a time. Just one, one, one. You get closer to Christ by becoming closer to each other. As Jesus said, whatever you do to the least of my brethren, you do it to me. So you begin. I begin. I picked up one person. Maybe if I didn't pick up that one person, I wouldn't have picked up the others. The whole work is only a drop in the ocean. But if we didn't put the drop in, the ocean would be one drop less. Same thing for you. Same thing in your family. Same thing in the church where you go. Just begin. One, one, one.
When I was a 13-year-old, Mother Teresa was an icon who I admired, and my admiration for her only grew. As a sophomore in college, I can still distinctly remember when, for Christmas, my birthday was the day after Christmas, my parents had this box under the tree, and I thought that I was getting keys to a clunker car. Instead, I opened it and had this book. It's more of a photographic rendition of Mother Teresa. And I was moved to tears when I read the inside cover of what my dad had written. I can't fully identify all of my intrigue with Mother Teresa. Perhaps it was her unwavering dedication to God. And maybe it was her undying service to the poorest of the poor. Neither of which I could really fully understand. I couldn't fathom experiencing God in such a real way, to be moved to give so much of my life to God in service. But there was something within me, a little longing within me, that wanted that. Somewhere along the way, I deemed that I would not, could not be another Mother Teresa. And for those of you who know me, you may laugh, but I wasn't going to be her. I was different. and I would do it differently. And I would take her life as a challenge to my own life on how I would live. And I committed to make myself available to God, to live my faith, one person, one situation, and one step at a time. As the quote that Julia read said, just beginning, one, one, one. I never would have thought that 20-some years later, another Catholic nun would drive me to reflect on my faith in a similar kind of way, how I was living out my faith, my values, my beliefs. But this time, it happened in Myanmar, some of you may know as Burma, a country in Southeast Asia. It was my first time to visit this country, and I knew little about the country, the politics, the culture, and the people. I was pretty naive, but I thought I knew a few things, and I'll tell you those things just to set the stage for the story. I knew that there were government sanctions imposed on this country, that they were largely targeted at the military government for their reported human rights abuses, including child labor, child soldiers, slavery, human trafficking, rape, and inhibiting people to speak about or into the governmental system. I knew that this country had just experienced a devastating cyclone that reports say killed more than 100,000 people, causing more than $10 billion worth in damage. And I knew from personal experience that the government resisted any international aid and left the already poor Delta people without food, clothing, water, shelter, many of them wandering, dying, or facing death. I also knew that because of the history of Myanmar, the people were very cautious about who they talked to and communicated with, and that fear was part of how they lived. I was also aware on this first visit that our group had been followed, and that we were possibly being watched and monitored, our conversations. I was in an unknown place, talking with unknown people, and to say that I was anxious would be a bit of an understatement. But the longer I was there, I was moved by the people that I encountered. And this is when I engaged Sister Mary. We walked to her office in 100-degree weather, 80% humidity. This was Southeast Asia, and I was supposed to be used to it, but I was sweating profusely. And so as we entered into this church, it was a bit stuffy. And then we went into her interior office, which was even more stuffy, and it had an air conditioner in the corner that was chugging away, trying to produce or spit out 1 ounce of cold. And I was convinced by the time that cold reached my side of the room, it turned hot. I remember almost every detail of this room. I remember sitting in a chair that had a nail poking into my leg. I remember sweat accumulating in every crack and crevice you can imagine. I remember minimal decoration, 2 big desks. We were all crammed in there together, and I remember Sister Mary. I don't remember her face, although if I met her on the street today, I might remember her, but I remember the emotion and the care and the compassion with which she spoke of her people and her dedication to serving God. As I listened to her, I knew that I was in the presence of God, and the work that she was doing was the embodiment of God's work. And at the risk of sounding cliche, but making myself be true to the story, I have to tell you that I pinched myself. I wanted to remember her. I wanted to remember that feeling. And I wanted to remember the wonder that I had about how someone like me could have the opportunity to sit in an office with someone like her, to experience with awe the way that she was working, doing God's work. I wondered how someone so ordinary could be doing so many extraordinary things. I listened to her with amazement and awe, knowing that she put her life at risk to do so. She humbly did her work, day in and day out, attending to one thing at a time. Just one, one, one. Throughout the Bible, there are examples of ordinary people doing just the one thing that they're called to do, following God's invitation to the one, integrating their values, their beliefs into the way they live. Many of them we know well: Abraham, Moses, Joseph, John the Baptist, Rahab, Mary, Paul. But there are also a few characters that are less significant, mentioned once or twice. In fact, many of us might think that they're insignificant. But they're ordinary people living out their faith. And in Exodus 1, that's what we have. Two women, Shiphrah and Puah. I don't know if you know them, but you soon will. Living out their faith. It was at the time of Joseph. Joseph had just died, and there was a new king. This king wasn't familiar with who Joseph was or had been, but it was evident that God was fulfilling his promises to the Israelite people to increase their numbers, to multiply them, to make them fruitful. And the king was getting a bit threatened, a bit worried about what was happening in this whole setting. And so his first device to get rid of these Israelites was to oppress them even more. So he orders them to work harder, and inevitably it doesn't work. The harder they oppress them, the more they multiply and prosper. So he moves to his second line of how he was going to decrease this threat. And in verse 15 of chapter 1 it says, "Then Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, gave this order to the Hebrew midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. When you help the Hebrew women give birth, kill all the boys as soon as they're born. Allow only the baby girls to live." But because the midwives feared God, they refused to obey the king and allowed the boys to live too. Then the king called for the midwives. "Why have you done this?" he demanded. "Why have you allowed the boys to live?" "Sir," they told them, "the Hebrew women are very strong. They have their babies so quickly that we can't get there in time. They're not slow in giving birth like the Egyptian women." So God blessed the midwives, and the Israelites continued to multiply, growing more and more powerful. Shiphrah and Puah probably weren't the only midwives who were caring for more than a million people. They were probably the supervisors of several midwives, midwives called to care for the women and babies as they're giving birth, to do everything they can to keep them alive, who are now being given this order by the king to commit murder. I think it puts them in an awkward dilemma. And they were given these orders like any other kind of government official would have been given orders. The king didn't give them through someone else. The king was talking them to them directly, saying, "This is what I need you to do for me." And then calls them back and says, "Why didn't you do it?" So I can't imagine when Shiphrah and Puah left the presence of the king that they were wondering what his orders were or were not. They were pretty clear that this is what they were to do. But I would also suspect, knowing the background here of what we know about them, that their conversation as they left the king probably wasn't, "Should we follow his orders or not?" The problem or the question they were facing was, "How can we probably discreetly defy what the king has ordered us to do?" We know that we're putting our lives on the line by defying him. How can we make sure that the midwives who are in our care and the Hebrew boys who we feel responsible for don't risk their lives as well? And so they devised a courageous and imaginative plan that saved the lives of several Hebrew boys, and we assume, this being the story that precedes that of Moses, that his life was one of them. They were faithful to God's invitation to do the one thing in their ability to do. They put their faith into action. Their values were expressed through the way that they lived, and they saved lives. Throughout my life, I've been challenged to examine the way that I live, to put my beliefs and my values into action. And I often ask the question, is my life reflecting those things? Is my life showing my beliefs like Mother Teresa, like Sister Mary, like Shifra, like Pua, like all the other people who I experience as mentors around me? And instead of allowing myself to become overwhelmed by my inadequacies, my imperfections, my inefficiencies, or to become complacent, thinking somebody else will do it, I've committed myself to pay attention to God, one person, one situation, one step at a time. Life has meaning when we integrate our values into action, into the way that we live. And as people of faith, in living with purpose, we creatively participate in bringing God's kingdom to this world. And so, on this morning, I leave you with one question. How is it for you? How does your life reflect what you believe? And maybe just, I'll sneak in another one. What invitation might God have for you? Each of you unique and different, with different gifts, different personalities, and I would expect different invitations, different calls. In the next couple moments, I'd invite you just to sit with that question and maybe make it a prayer. God, what is your invitation for me today, throughout this week? To the one.
We must not drift away from the humble works, because these are the works nobody will do. It is never too small. We are so small, and we look at things in a small way. But God, being almighty, sees everything great. Therefore, even if you write a letter for a blind man, or just go and listen, or you take the mail for him, or you visit somebody, or bring a flower to somebody, small things, or wash clothes for somebody, or clean the house, very humble work, that is where you and I must be. For there are many people who do big things, but there are very few people who will do the small things. Just begin. One, one, one.
May you go knowing that God goes with you, and pay attention this week, in a very busy week, in the last week. Pay attention today, in the days to come, in the weeks to come, in the summer to come, in whatever comes, to God's invitation for you, to the one.